It's Friday, February 26, and the U.S. just hit back. We start here. In his first military action as president, Joe Biden authorizes airstrikes near the Iraqi border.
The U.S. really couldn't let that pass.
Martha Raddatz tells us what message is being sent to Iran. It's the biggest Republican event of the year, but who's in charge of the party?
There might be a Republican civil war going on, but CPAC isn't going to showcase it.
We preview former President Trump's return to the stage this weekend. And as a third vaccine nears the finish line for emergency approval, some have barely begun the fight.
Even as far as 9 months out from their initial and acute infection, they were experiencing these symptoms.
What the latest data is telling us about COVID long haulers. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Michelle Franzen. Hi there. Brad's off today.
Thanks, everyone. We're going to get a call.
Thank you.
Yes.
President Biden closing out the week, keeping his focus on the Middle East. The White House says the president spoke with Saudi King Salman for the first time since taking office. That as the Biden administration prepares to release a declassified U.S. intelligence report on the findings of the 2018 killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
That report is expected to conclude that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, ordered the brutal attack.
And today, tensions taking a new turn.
And breaking tonight, the United States has conducted a military airstrike in eastern Syria along the border with Iraq.
The U.S. carried out airstrikes in eastern Syria near the Iraqi border, targeting infrastructure used by Iranian-backed militias. It is President Biden's first major military action since taking office. ABC News Chief Global Affairs Correspondent Martha Raddatz joins us. Martha, where did the U.S. target those strikes and what happened leading up to this?
President Biden had little choice but to carry out some sort of counterattack.
An American-led military base in Iraq has been hit by rockets in the deadliest attack on U.S. forces there in almost a year.
Because an Iranian-backed militia, the U.S. and coalition partners believed, carried out an attack on a coalition base in Erbil.
The target appears to be U.S. forces based near the airport, part of the alliance fighting ISIS.
A contractor, a coalition contractor, was killed. A U.S. service member was injured, and several U.S. contractors were also injured. It was quite an alarming attack. Erbil rarely gets any sort of attack, but President Biden asked that this retaliatory strike be carried out.
We're confident in the target that we went after. We know what we hit. And we're confident that that target was being used by the same Shia militia that conducted the strikes.
They attacked infrastructure of Iranian-backed militias. They said it was a strike that was meant to de-escalate the situation in the Middle East, but they believe, obviously, it was retaliatory. It was something they had to do.
What does this all mean for tensions and also talks for the U.S. and Iran and Middle East allies?
It is a very tense time with Iran anyway. Iran wants to get back, as does the United States, to some sort of nuclear agreement.
Iran is out of compliance on a number of fronts, and it would take some time, should it make the decision to do so, for it to come back into compliance.
The U.S. would like to get back to the table with Iran and rejoin with some changes, with some more strict changes with Iran to that nuclear agreement that former President Trump took the United States out of.
They're basically signaling to the United States, look, this is a dangerous neighborhood. You come to negotiate with us, and you come to negotiate with us now. You cannot wait a few more months until you deal with the coronavirus at home. This is an urgent situation as far as the
So Iranian this retaliatory is strike is meant to say, look, now we're even. You attacked in your militias, attacked in Erbil. We're going to carry out a retaliatory strike and let's go on from there.
And you think that this could theoretically clear the slate for talks to resume?
It certainly puts the talks back on a more level playing field because the U.S. really couldn't let that pass. They cannot let a coalition partner be killed. They cannot let a U.S. service member be injured and several American contractors be injured as well.
We said a number of times We will respond at, you know, on our timeline.
It's that old thing. You really can't make threats and say, don't do this, don't carry out any attacks, or we'll pay back without actually paying back.
Martha Raddatz, thank you, as always.
Okay, thanks.
The Grand Old Party's brand has centered on small government, low taxes, and fiscally conservative policies. But what does the GOP party stand for today following the Trump presidency?
I want you to know that the movement we started is only just beginning. There's never been anything like it.
The former president will be the keynote speaker at this weekend's CPAC in Orlando, Florida. That annual conference already underway. And there may be more going on behind the scenes of what could be called the party of the grand old personality. ABC's political director Rick Klein joins us to break it all down. Rick, let's start with the former president speaking on Sunday. It will be his first major appearance since leaving office.
Yeah, and look, there might be a Republican civil war going on, but CPAC isn't going to showcase it. This is the Trump party, and it will be on full display.
Please welcome Senator Ted Cruz.
Usually this group has been something of a barometer for conservative thought.
So Donald Trump is skipping CPAC.
And in 2016, Trump skipped the gathering and was widely panned among conservatives for doing so.
So he was told there were conservatives that were going to be here.
That President Trump is here endorsing and supporting my campaign, and I look.
But a lot changed in the years since then, and it comes full circle now for him to make his first post-presidential major political speech, to have it at CPAC, and to have really almost no one on the speaking lineup who will say a crossword about President Trump. People like Liz Cheney, Adam Kinzinger, Ben Sasse, even Nikki Haley and Mike Pence, none of those folks are attending. This will be a Trumpy gathering, and President Trump will have his say and have yet another big moment.
Is this a chance for him to reclaim or continue to claim the party?
Well, that's the thing, is that he never really lost hold of it. It's being called a comeback, but coming back from what? He hasn't really gone anywhere. He still is the dominant force inside the Republican Party, but there are big cross currents going on.
Do you believe President Trump should be speaking, or former President Trump should be speaking at CPAC this weekend?
Yes, he should.
And you saw it on display just this week where Kevin McCarthy, the top House Republican, is asked, should Trump be at CPAC? He says, of course he should.
Congresswoman Cheney?
That's up to CPAC. I've been clear my views about that.
Liz Cheney, the number three House Republican who voted for impeachment, said, no, I don't think he has any future at all in the Republican Party.
I don't believe that he should be playing a role in the future of the party or the country.
On that high note, thank you all very much.
You see Republicans willing to step out there and break with him, but there doesn't seem to be much of an upside for them.
But I expect he will continue playing a role. I don't know if he'll run in 2024 or not, but if he does, I'm pretty sure he will win the nomination.
If the president was the party's nominee, would you support him?
The nominee of the party? Absolutely.
We are told he will be talking about his political future, teasing potentially running in 2024. Whether or not he does so, though, he's going to be a major force, even if there are folks out there that think that's a bad idea for Republicans.
There's talk of unity, but there's also a lot going on, as we mentioned, behind the scenes, a lot of fissures within the party. Just this week, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene stepping out again, making headlines this time, putting up a sign outside her congressional office across the hall from Representative Marie Newman of Illinois, who has a transgender daughter. Give us a little background on what's going on with that.
Yeah, I mean, they're unlikely office mates or offices or partners or neighbors, I should say, right across the hall from each other, diametrically opposed on politics.
I'd also like to address the entire 117th Congress and say that the Equality Act is not about stopping discrimination. It's about causing discrimination against women and religious freedoms. I would like to motion to adjourn, Madam Speaker.
There's a bill that the House of Representatives is advancing to move forward on transgender rights. Marjorie Taylor Greene thinks it's a bad idea. She's tried to shut down Congress a few times around it.
You should be concerned for the safety of all the little girls that are going to go in a bathroom not knowing if there is a man in there that calls himself a woman.
The right time to pass this act was decades ago. The second best time is right now. I'm voting yes on the Equality Act for Evie Newman, my daughter, and the strongest, bravest person I know. Thank you, and I yield back.
And her neighbor there, Congresswoman Newman, put a sign out, put a flag up for transgender rights. There was retaliation, another sign that says that gender is between male and female, and that's it. And a lot of, frankly, pretty hurtful speech being hurled back and forth. Marjorie Taylor Greene is known as a rabble-rouser. We know that she's already been kicked off her committees for other comments that she has made. And I think there's a lot of members of Congress that don't want to give her too much of a platform.
It's not a controversial issue anymore. 83% of Americans support anti-discrimination legislation for LGBTQ Americans, 68% of Republican voters. So this is not a controversial issue. We've built a coalition.
But there is still a divide in the Republican Party about what you do around some of these issues. Now that the Democrats have full control of Washington, they can push bills advancing transgender rights. They can move to new territory on spending bills as well. And some of these areas are going to be uncomfortable for some Republicans.
The Biden administration is making it easy for us to get together, and I think we've unified in opposition to this new administration's extremely progressive approach.
At the same time, you've got just about all Republicans set to, if not all Republicans, set to vote against Joe Biden's COVID package. And it's an odd cause to bring party unity.
So let's get this done. I've gotten over 400 mayors contacting me to get this plan passed. A lot of you have moved to do that.
There's broad popularity for COVID relief and some of the specifics of what Biden wants to do. So the fact that Republicans are closing ranks to oppose him on that and are likely to all vote today to oppose it, that's a statement as well. And it suggests a party that in some ways can see its future and be quite optimistic, in other ways really can't even decide which direction to go.
Thanks, Rick. And a ruling last night by the Senate parliamentarian delivered a blow to the president's rescue package, ruling that the $15 minimum wage hike proposal was not permissible in the COVID relief bill. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says the president was, quote, disappointed in that ruling, but respects the decision. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi signaling that the House will move forward with a full vote today, including the minimum wage hike. Rick, thanks.
Thank you.
Next up on Start Here, the hidden struggles of surviving COVID-19. What researchers are learning about the so-called long haulers?
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Today, President Biden heads to the Lone Star State as Comforter-in-Chief, his first official trip to Texas since taking office. He and the First Lady will survey the damage and recovery efforts from the historic winter storms that led to the power grid outages and outrage. The president will also visit a COVID vaccination center. It comes a day after the White House marked 50 million vaccinations nationwide, halfway to the goal to administer 100 million shots in his first 100 days in office.
In 5 weeks, America's administered the most shots of any country in the world.
Add to that, a third COVID-19 vaccine is in the final stages of the approval pipeline.
If the FDA approves the use of this new vaccine, we have a plan to roll it out as quickly as Johnson & Johnson can make it.
An FDA panel meets today to review Johnson & Johnson's single-shot vaccine for emergency use authorization.
I was so angry for so long because I would see people outside partying when I could barely walk 2 feet to my window.
In just the past year, the pandemic has claimed more than 500,000 American lives, a number that will continue to climb. Health experts say COVID is taking another toll. Millions more have contracted COVID-19 and are still here to tell about it, surviving, but not necessarily thriving.
Trying to figure out why my heart is so high, my heart rate is so high, and I can't move from the couch and I can't breathe.
They're known as the long haulers, the journey to healing from a variety of symptoms ever present and ever changing, still not fully known. But now researchers are tracking some of them and we're learning a little bit more about the serious road ahead for many. ABC's Sasha Pesnik is here to tell us all about a new study from the University of Washington. Sasha, we don't always hear about this group, the people who recovered, who have symptoms on the onset, and now are dealing with different medical issues. Do we know just how many people are known as long haulers?
Yeah, so they took a look, and to be clear, this is a small study, just about 200 participants, but it really does add to a growing body of data indicating that these long-haul symptoms, they impact more people and in more serious ways than we maybe initially thought. This study took a look at COVID survivors and found that even as far as 9 months out from their initial and acute infection, they were experiencing these symptoms.
You can do well initially, but then you can, over time, then develop symptoms that are quite crippling.
And some finding it really just hard to keep up with their day-to-day activities as a result of these rather mysterious symptoms.
Approximately 30% of the patients who were enrolled at the University of Washington reported persistent symptoms for as long as 9 months after illness.
It's getting the attention of public health leaders now. Dr. Anthony Fauci saying this week how alarming some of what we're finding is. The NIH is now looking into it further. One recent study out saying roughly a third of participating COVID survivors reported persistent symptoms, worse health and quality of life as compared to before their infection.
The key takeaway of this study is that in people who have coronavirus, who may not actually be that sick when they're acutely infected, they may then go on to develop long-term symptoms.
I still am on oxygen. I try not to be as much. That way I can get my lungs stronger.
Everything from ongoing, sometimes debilitating fatigue, cough, and loss of taste and smell.
My taste completely changed. So there's a lot of foods that I don't eat anymore, that they were my favorite.
Body aches, headaches, joint pain, trouble concentrating. They call it brain fog, that it can include memory loss and other cognitive impairments.
Caitlin can't walk on her own. She's so weak, her husband and family have to help her walk, stand, even shower.
Are you worried is your life going to go back to normal?
Absolutely. It's been 6 months and I don't know what my future holds.
We're seeing the real all-out attack that COVID seems to launch on our entire systems.
We're rounding the corner in many ways with cases dropping, vaccinations are, you know, ramping up. But what does this mean for long-term health needs and costs when we're talking about, again, another rescue package and health needs for people down the road?
Right, absolutely. I think, first of all, for so many people battling these long COVID symptoms, the most difficult part is that there are just not many answers out there.
What's really challenging as a physician in this situation is that we honestly don't know. And so when patients ask me, am I going to be sick for the rest of my life? I don't know if they're going to be sick for the rest of their life.
There are a handful of clinics opening up around the country that are now catering specifically to COVID long-haul patients.
At Mount Sinai, the post-COVID clinic currently seeing more than 500 long-hauler patients. The waiting list to get in, growing.
It is a large group, almost tsunami-like, that will just hit us over the next, I think, 6 months.
These post-COVID clinics that are offering specific care with these wide-ranging symptoms and try to get them the support they so badly need to help them get on the road to recovery, however long that may be.
So this is a place where maybe some therapeutics might be able to come in as well. Sasha, thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Throughout the month of February, we've been inviting contributors to describe events around us that are inextricably tied to American history, and more specifically, Black history. We've heard about sports, criminal justice, and education. Well, to close out this series, ABC's Beatrice Peterson wanted to offer her analysis on the latest solution to America's oldest problem. Beatrice has been reporting on slavery reparations for years, and yet, here in 2021, we have seen news unfolding on this just in the last week. Here's her audio essay.
And one last thing. It all started with a promise. Shortly before the Civil War ended, Special Field Order 15, a promise of 40 acres by Union General William T. Sherman,
The talk was that each black who was emancipated would be given 40 acres and a mule.
That 1856 declaration was the foundation of reparations in America.
But shortly after that field order was issued, you know that Lincoln was assassinated. President Johnson was a Southern sympathizer, so it didn't take long for that field order to be voided.
164 years and 41 presidential cycles later, reparations were still being debated among presidential candidates.
We're not talking about a gift to anybody. We're talking about mending what was broken.
That great injustice has had to do with the fact that there was 250 years of slavery, followed by another 100 years of domestic terrorism.
And somehow, last week, the new White House press secretary sounded flummoxed when it came up.
But he certainly would support a study of reparations. We understand that we don't need a study to take action right now in systemic racism, so he wants to take actions within his own government in the meantime.
As I've crossed the country reporting on reparations over the years, I've had people ask me, white, black, and every shade in between, what qualifies as reparations? If you search the definition of reparations on Google, it's explained as the making of amends for a wrong, or the action of repairing something.
We've, you know, tried to deal with our original sin of slavery by fighting a civil war, by passing landmark civil rights legislation. We've elected an African-American president.
Critics of the issue often say if reparations were decided today, how and where do you start? What does it look like and who gets reparations? What many critics don't know is that for the last 30 years, there has been a simple answer to that question, sitting in Congress waiting for a vote. In 1989, one bill, H.R. 40, numbered for the centuries-long promise of 40 acres, was first introduced into the House of Representatives. The bill calls for the creation of a commission to study and develop proposals for reparations.
We would then create the first body of government literature on the subject.
H.R. 40 has been introduced in every legislative session for over three decades. And, like clockwork, the bill has never made it to a floor vote in the House of Representatives, a building, ironically, built by slaves.
Now more than ever, the facts and circumstances facing our nation demonstrate the importance of H.R. 40.
The bill's lead sponsor, Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, believes that now is the time to pass it into law.
And I also join with the Biden administration that says we can do many things at once. It's a healing factor.
However, it's still unclear how much support Lee will get from the White House.
Would he support the bill? Because you're talking about the study, but if the bill came to his desk, would he sign it?
Well, it's working its way through Congress. He'd certainly support a study, but we'll see what happens through the legislative process.
Meanwhile, outside of Washington, local and state governments have acknowledged their role in the slave trade. Nine states have apologized. For many Black Americans, an apology is a start. However, it isn't enough. They're seeking restorative justice.
There are a lot of eyes on us right now as a city and as a possible model that can be replicated in localities across the nation.
In Evanston, Illinois, city leaders have a reparations fund, which uses private contributions and tax revenue collected from the sales of legal recreational marijuana to support home ownership for Evanston residents and their direct descendants.
Governor Gavin Newsom signed a first-of-its-kind law forming a task force to study the state's role in slavery.
And in California, state lawmakers passed their version of H.R. 40. Black Americans have been waiting generations for a decision on reparations. It's been debated over kitchen tables and at family cookouts. My family is no different. My grandfather was born in 1902. He died before I could meet him. But ironically, H.R. 40 was introduced in his lifetime and mine as well. Sometimes, randomly, in the silence of the night, I wonder, if one day I have a child, will Congress still be debating how to begin a process that was supposed to begin so long ago?
And our
Thanks to Beatrice Peterson for her reporting and her analysis there. Start Here is produced by David Rind, Kelly Therese, Josh Cohan, Lewis Millman, Ariel Chester, Tara Gimbel, and Lauren Efron. Thanks to Liz Alessi, Eric Johnson, Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, Abe Velez, and Stacia Deshishku. Special thanks this week to Victor Ordonez, Eliana Laramendia, Ignacio Torres, Chris Howe, Leighton Schneider, Tony Fanick, Chris Berry, Drew Milhan, Jennifer Cosi, Micah Cohen, and Gina Sinceri. I'm Michelle Franzen. Brad's back on Monday. Have a great weekend.